Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Good to see you all. People keep talking about the weather. It's very interesting weather. One of my friends said to me as we were leaving here in the rain the other day, "I love weather." That was nice. Sometimes we want to have an argument with the weather. Who's going to win that one? But you know, even though I don't think it's all that helpful to talk about how the weather isn't something that I like, the weather does kind of touch us, you know. It touches us in an immediate way. So that's real, you know. If the sun is here, that's some part of us, some pretty deep part of us really responds to that. And if the sun isn't here for a long time, then there's something else that occurs, you know, pretty deep in our bodies and our minds. And so, you know, I might say, don't waste your time complaining about the weather. I might also say, wow, you should pay attention to how the weather makes you feel. Just be attentive to what's happening in your consciousness. Because then, if it's making you cranky, you might be able to skip being unkind to somebody. That's the main reason. So I'm going to talk about weather for 45 minutes. And then I'm going to give a Dharma talk. I'm going to talk today. I have this talk that I titled Meet a Teacher, Practice, and Be Well. And the title just came out. I was looking through this book that I have called The First Buddhist Women. And I just wanted to find some way to give a talk out of this book. And I came across this verse, section of this verse that said, wrong page. There I am. Wait a minute, finding it. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged, 7 days full of joy. I heard what she said, meet a teacher. Sat cross-legged for 7 days, practice, doesn't have to be 7 days. Full of joy, be well. Meet a teacher, practice, and be well. And this is a theme that runs throughout Buddhist literature. Arguably, it runs throughout human culture. But that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I just want to say, I wanted to give a talk using material from this book, which is called The First Buddhist Women by Susan Murcott, because if you want to give a talk, you want to be like, I'm a Dharma teacher, I'm going to give a talk based on some teachings by a woman from our tradition. In the English language, you have a choice of about 4 books that you can choose from to get material. So maybe that statement is painful, but it's true. And I just want to say at the beginning, everyone here should buy this book. And everyone here should write a letter to Susan Murcott saying, I wish you'd make another book. And everyone here should write a letter to Parallax Press, Wisdom Publishing, and Chambala Publishing, and say, we'd like more books that are translations of texts by women from this tradition. Okay, that's my little pitch, my sales pitch. Because a wonderful thing is happening in the United States, where we're going from a tradition where women have not been brought into the highest levels of leadership within Buddhism for 2,500 years. And now that's changing in the U.S. very, very rapidly, which is cool. But one way we can kind of support this energy of empowering people who have been not empowered in the past, or a community of people, is by looking into the past and seeing, oh, what did people create that was forgotten? What did people create that was forgotten? And it's not just that this stuff was forgotten in English, actually. There's not a lot of literature preserved through Asian culture of women's teachings, but there's some. We've got a little bit, and I know there's more. So if we as a community kind of stand up and say, hey, we'd like more of this, someone who's a lot smarter than me, who knows Sanskrit or Chinese, and is willing to dig around in ancient texts, will actually go and dig for this, bring it back, and then dumb guys like me can talk about it, because smart people dug it up. So anyway, that's why I make this pitch for this, because if, as a community, we recognize the need for this, something can flower out of that that I think will be beneficial for everyone. So, meet a teacher, practice, and be well. There was, in the earliest Buddhist culture, according to the records that we have, there were nuns and monks, and they all studied, and they all considered themselves students of Buddha. And that's a long and interesting history in and of itself. One of the there's a story about this. There was a woman named Padachara. She's probably the second most famous Buddhist teacher that there is. Padachara. And she had had such a horrible series of traumas in her life that she was completely crazy, pretty much. You can read about the stories or hear about the stories of what those traumas were, but they were really extreme. And the result was that she had lived for many years by herself in the wilds, naked, just foraging and scrounging garbage for food. So she was not exactly like on the inside of society. And apparently, so she'd been like this for a long time, and one day the Buddha was walking by with a group of his followers, I guess. They were going to go to a different town, so they'd walk from town to town. And they saw her by the riverbank, and all the monks were like, uh-oh, naked lady. That woman looks not well and scary. But apparently the Buddha just approached her, and he said, it's time to recover your presence of mind. It's time to recover your presence of mind. When, my friends, is it not time to recover your presence of mind? This is simple instruction you could have given to anyone. But he just approached her. Is it really nice to just walk up to people and give them instructions? Well, what we know is the result of this interaction was that she suddenly was struck by this meeting with this teacher. Standing on a riverbank, a naked woman with matted hair, on the brink of starvation, and an old monk. He said, it's time to recover your presence of mind. And she went, oh, what am I doing? And she borrowed a robe from one of the other monks. And she said, can I come with you? He said, yeah, sure. Come along. And she began to practice meditation and the precepts, which is the guidelines for compassionate action that were laid forth in that time and we still use today. And she practiced with him for a long time. And I believe under another woman teacher named Maha Pachapati, who is Buddha's stepmom who raised him, since his mother died in birth. And Padachara became a great teacher. They say at the end that she had 300 followers. That was a lot in those days, and 300 basically means a whole bunch in this language. So we don't know how many she had, but she was thought to be one of the great teachers. And we have these little snippets of things that her followers said. Padachara, she guided me in leaving home, encouraged me, and urged me to the highest goal. That's one woman. Someone describes, they stood up, then bowed to her feet. We have taken your advice and will live honoring you. These were nuns under Padachara. I went to a nun I thought I could trust, Uttama. She pulled out the arrow hidden in my heart. So these are just a few. We have just a tiny little bit of records of the lives of these women, the first practitioners of Buddhism. And then we have these little records of them saying, oh, I met a teacher. I met a teacher, and it touched me. So Padachara came, her encounter with her teacher came out of this just unbelievable degree of suffering and chaos in her life. And for some people here, that may be why you are here. None of you are naked with matted hair, and none of you look like you're near starving, but there may be people in this room who are really pretty desperate. That may be true. My heart goes out to you if that is. But people come here for a lot of reasons. Some people are just kind of like, I'm a little tense. You know? That's enough. Isn't that enough suffering to want to be well? Some people, I think, are like, you know, what is the meaning of life? Well, I don't know if we'll figure that out, but we can help you be less tense. So people have some kind of philosophical drive that brings them to Zen practice. Or some people just want to be around a community of people who are kind of committed to wellness, the wellness of the world, so they come here. Some people just want to serve their community. So there's a lot of motivations that for a lot of people. It's kind of mixed up. A lot of the stories of these earliest Buddhist wisdom, women came through the door of extreme suffering. So that's kind of what we have for them. But it's various now. It's various. So one of Padachara's students or followers was called Uttama. And okay, this is problematic because maybe there were two Uttamas. So the records are a little bit, it looks like maybe there were two, but maybe it's the records got screwed up, so there's one. We're just going to act like there's one Uttama who wrote a couple things, okay? So if you guys want to contradict my scholarship, that's fine. Anyway, so I just want to read this poem that Uttama left us. Four or five times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, the earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. When on the eighth day I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So we have this woman. It says in here she left her cell. It's a little puzzling to me because from what I know, they didn't have any monasteries or buildings for practicing in at this time. Mostly what they talk about is Buddha will say, sit at the roots of trees, which is where he experiences enlightenment. Highly recommend sitting at the root of a tree. Trees will really show you how to do zazen. They never wiggle around a lot, at least down at the base. sit at the roots of trees or in huts. They had huts sort of scattered around northern India that I think were erected by people who were meditating and also by people who wanted to support meditators. They're just, you know, pretty bare bones. So you go in an empty hut or you go into a roots of trees. So I don't know why she says cell here. I wonder. Sounds to me like maybe she's meditating in a hut. But here we have this person. Four or five times I left my cell. She's like, I want to commit to this practice. But I keep, can I go do something else? Four or five times. She's gone. I want to do something else. So what's described here is just this impulse to get up and get away from the practice. I know I'm the only one here who's ever had this impulse. Like, oh, can I look at my clock again? How soon is Paul going to ring that bell? The deep question. Don't we have a piece that you've played many times for us on the Shakuhachi Leo called Longing for the Bell?
Right.
Longing for the Bell. I've been there 4 or 5 times. I left my cell. I had no peace of mind. I had no control over my mind. So we don't tend to talk about the language of controlling the mind here too much in Zen. It's a little bit more the flavor of the earliest Buddhist practice, which is a little different than the way we do here. But this sense that the mind is just, you begin to see how it's making the suffering that you experience. That's not something that's out there, but it's just these patterns of thoughts. Like, oh, she can see this, but it's like, even though she knows it's true, she's like, I keep running out. So she's, what am I going to do? So she went to a nun she thought she could trust. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. So she goes to Padachara. Someone who had been absolutely, I mean, really, I've seen homeless people, I've been friends with homeless people, I've been friends with many people with profound mental illnesses and all kinds of problems. I haven't met a lot of people who are wandering around in the woods naked with matted hair. I mean, she was as low as you can go. I'm not saying she's lower than anyone else. She was as low as you can go in the wretchedness of the human condition. And what happened was, she met a teacher, she did the practice, and she became an inspiration for hundreds of people to transform their lives. And she's still inspiring me. So probably millions of people. So this fortunate Uttama had Padachara for a teacher. She went to a nun she thought she could trust. This trust is really important. So meeting a teacher, I think, is really important. I met my teacher, Tim Burkett, about 12 years ago. I first started coming here for morning zazen, and I would just sit. And they'd start ringing bells and chanting, and I would basically flee out the door in a panic. I was like, you guys are weird. But then, you know, after a while, I sat around and did some chanting, and I was like, oh, this chanting is kind of beautiful, actually. That's cool. And then I started coming here on Sundays, and there was this guy, Tim, talking, and I was like, well, I like this guy. This is interesting to me. And then one day I was sitting, and someone came and said, Tim's doing Dokusan, do you want to meet him? And I was like, sure. Because I don't know what it is, I'm very fortunate. When I came here, I was just like, well, I'll try anything. What the heck? So I didn't really have any idea what that was, but it seemed kind of alarming. You know, I'm sitting here in zazen, everyone's dead silent, and then this bell rings, and it's like, okay, you go upstairs, and you go into his room, and you bow at the door, and I'm like, oh, God, is he going to hit me with a stick? Have you guys read about this hitting you with a stick stuff? Maybe we should just get rid of that literature, because I don't think it's helping. Anyway, so he didn't hit me with a stick. I did meet with a Zen teacher in Los Angeles Zen Center once, and I came in, and he was sitting there with his big stick in his lap. And I was like, oh, God help me. Here we go. He was the nicest person I've ever met. Okay, well, I've met a lot of nice people. But anyway, so I went up and met with Tim. And sometimes people say, what are you supposed to do when you meet with a teacher here? And I'm like, I really should have an answer for that. What have I done? We don't really have a method. Tim's never explained it to me, really. But meeting someone face-to-face with your whole heart and your whole mind has been central to this practice for the whole time. Almost every single record we have of Buddhism from the first teaching of Buddha till this moment has been people meeting each other. Some people listening and some speaking, sometimes with more exchange, sometimes with more of a whatever this is, holding forth. This is powerful. And the one-to-one meeting, there's so many records of this. Uttama, I went to a teacher I thought I could trust. I had no peace of mind. I went to a teacher I thought I could trust. So we have to trust somebody, or we have to make a little effort. It's probably a good idea to find out whether you should trust somebody, because some people are not trustworthy. So this isn't about like, yes, you should give absolute faith in the teacher and trust them no matter what they do. No, don't do that. But find someone you trust, and then go meet them. And what is the method? To just bring yourself and be honest. That's all I've done the whole time. First time I went out, I didn't know what I was doing. I was like, when everyone is walking around the room really quietly and slowly, what are they doing? You know, I've been coming here for 4 months doing walking meditation. I had no idea what was happening. And he's like, well, we're meditating. Oh, good. You know, I didn't know. Then I kept meeting with Tim, and when I came here, I was in a lot of emotional pain, so I'd go in there and talk about how my life sucked. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, apparently that's true. He just met me. He didn't give me a lot of advice, but it profoundly changed my life. There's not a lot of methodology, but it's kind of like, is there a lot of methodology to Zazen? No. And yet we just sit, and something happens. Is there anyone here who's done lots of sitting meditation and hasn't seen it transform their life? Really, you can raise your hand, and no one will think it's bad. And meeting with someone, actually, to me, the practice of meeting with my teacher is Zazen. It's not a separate thing. That's why when we do Dokusan in traditional thing, when we ring the bell and you get up, there's no bowing or anything. You just stand up and go straight upstairs and sit down because your Zazen is uninterrupted. It's pure presence, giving yourself completely to the moment. So we have a lot of opportunities to do this around here, by the way. Yeah, so if you want to meet with somebody, just contact the office or talk to one of the teachers here, and the opportunity is there. It's a wonderful thing to do. Oh, you know what's another awesome expression of this encounter? This method of practice that is about a verbal exchange and encounter is the Shuso ceremony. How many people have been to a Shuso ceremony? How many people think Shuso ceremonies are pretty awesome? Similar numbers. So a Shuso ceremony is one where we take someone who's been ordained for a couple of years and they become the Shuso, which means head monk, and they sit in the front and people ask them questions, basically, and they answer questions. So it's a dialogue. In my experience, one of the more beautiful things that I ever get to be involved in or experience. So Wanda Isle is doing a Shuso ceremony a week from Sunday at 4 o'clock, and I definitely encourage you to be here for that. So they're really beautiful. Four or five times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind. I had no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception and earth, water, wind, and fire. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. So, I'm not going to talk about the teaching component, like what you're taught. Teaching component of this tradition is pretty cool. But actually, when I come here to do this, when I'm sitting there, or I'm sitting here, this is not about conveying information. I was working on this text where I have an editor. I have this book. I had written something about teaching, and this editor didn't like what I did, and they put in this sentence, after all, teaching is about conveying information. And I was like, that I can't do that. I can't see that in a book that has my name on it. It's not about information. This is about meeting each other right now. Right now. But the information can be helpful. That's cool. We can meet the information. Wow, information. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. 7 days full of joy. Let's all come to Rohatsu. We have a 7-day retreat here every year. It's always joyful, every moment. Well, some of us who've been here are laughing because long retreats can be hard. Long retreats can be hard. They can be joyful and they can be challenging. And they can be a lot of things. You pretty much get to do the whole panoply of what human experience can be and see that it's all right there coming out of your mind because nothing is happening. You're just sitting there. Sitting on a cushion, joy comes, despair comes, peace comes, tranquility comes, fabulous thoughts come, silence comes, and it's like nothing is happening but what my mind is doing. And she sat still though, and what happened is joy. Practice. If you do this practice, wellness is a resultant. I fail to live up to the great Zen tradition of saying Zazen is not good for anything. I fail. I'll fail again and again. Zazen is a transformative practice. I'm sorry, all you great Zen masters. I've seen it. How can I deny it? I've seen it in my life and the lives of others. But you have to do the practice. And the degree to which the beauty of this tradition flowers out of practice is directly proportional to the degree to which you give yourself to the practice. She sat down for 7 days. She made a commitment. She'd been practicing for a long time, but she was struggling. She went to her teacher. She became more committed. Her teacher helped her find that commitment. She did the practice. And what happened? Full of joy. Full of joy. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. When on the 8th I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So at the end here, Uttama does what almost every poem in this collection, which is called the Theragata, or the Poems of the Elder Nuns, does. They almost all end with a thing about how they attain nirvana. Woo, nirvana, that sounds cool. And here she does it, it's like exactly the way it happened to Buddha. He sat for 7 days, and that was the moment at which he had realization. So we get a certain degree of formulaic stuff in these verses. And I'll just say, so the idea in early Buddhism was you do the practice and you could attain nirvana, and that nirvana meant a complete cessation of having suffering occur in your consciousness or contributing to suffering in anyone else forever. No one I know has experienced this that has described it to me. So I'm sorry if you would like to experience a complete ending of suffering for all time and the capacity for you to end suffering, you may be in the wrong place. I'm sorry. But I'm not sorry, because who needs to do that? What about just the opportunity to be together and do this practice and see what's here in this moment? And this is the emphasis of our tradition. This is the emphasis that starts to emerge a few hundred years after Buddha's death through the Mahayana, and it begins to get stronger in Zen, and then it gets really big in Soto Zen. And so just be here in your life. Don't wait for nirvana. We don't have to figure out how to go beyond everything, because we can actually just be here in our lives. We can actually just devote the practice to being here in our lives right now. This is enough. It can be enough. So, yeah. She got nirvana. I didn't. I'm just complaining. So even though she met the teacher and that was transformative, she did the practice. As it says in the Dhammapada, all the effort must be made by you. Buddhas only show the way. Follow the path, practice meditation. It's kind of a drag. You should have gone to one of these places where they say there's someone else who does it for you, but oh well. Here we are. We get to do it. So I have another verse by Uttama. This could be a different Uttama, but they hung out together, or they were one person. The records are a little bit murky. The Buddha taught seven factors of enlightenment. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. I have found what is vast and empty, the unborn. It is what I have longed for. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, always finding joy in peace. I have ended the hunger of gods and humans, and I will not wander from birth to birth. I have no thought of becoming. So this one as well, the last verse is basically about entering nirvana and you don't have to be reborn and all this stuff. I don't know much about being reborn. I'll be interested to find out if that happens. So I'm not really going to talk about the line that sort of pertains to this idea of nirvana, but I just want to talk a little bit about the first couple lines. So even though Padachara was her teacher and the person she spent the most time with and was really intimate with, in this poem, she says, the Buddha taught seven factors of enlightenment. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. So she has a relationship with the Buddha, who would have been hanging out in the same area, and his teachings. So, you know, you can have lots of teachers. You can have teachers here, and you can have teachers at home, like your children, good teachers. You can just realize that people you meet who say things that are valuable or show you something valuable about yourself are teachers. And you can have teachers from any kind of religious tradition you want. So Padachara, she talks in two poems about two teachers with whom she has relationships. The Buddha taught seven factors of enlightenment. They are ways to find peace, and I have developed them all. I really resonate more with this idea of ways to find peace than trying to attain nirvana. Peace is something that I haven't always wanted, you know. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I want life to be pretty darn exciting. And when I was younger, I really wanted to be exciting. And it didn't matter to me if the excitement really sucked and was just all kinds of problems. It was at least something. It was kind of scary to really find peace. That's one of the reasons it's scary to sit in meditation. Our conscious is like, I don't really want to mellow out. I want to do my thing. You know what I mean? It's like it wants to reach out and grasp. But if we allow this to happen, if we put ourselves in this container of practice, then we can just taste peace and we can realize that, oh, it's not so bad. It's not so bad to not be poking our head and our preferences and our desires into everything that happens. It's actually pretty good. We can just be here. It's not only good for us because we just begin to have some ease in our lives, but it's really good for everyone else because we're not just out there running roughshod over our loved ones and the people we meet and the world. And we can begin to see that it's not all about our desires and our little tendencies that come up. We can just be peaceful and respond to what's here. The seven factors of enlightenment are mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. You can see how developing these would cultivate peace. mindfulness. And these all basically, if you were to give a long, you know, maybe a week-long series of talks about them, they're all basically taking apart the meditation process as seen by the earliest Buddhists. But they start with mindfulness. They move through kind of being aware with what's here, discrimination of phenomena. Energy. So we have to sustain that. You know, we have to do the practice 7 days full of joy. Right after energy, in the seven factors of enlightenment, comes rapture. Make the effort. Beauty ensues. Rapture, what? Rapt concentration. Have you ever done meditation practice and just found yourself for a moment or for a little while experiencing some rapt, joyful concentration? Some of us have, I'm pretty sure. Tranquility. Concentration. Equanimity. So actually, as the early Buddhists describe meditation, we don't really get into whether your meditation is deep or not. It's probably not a good idea around here. Maybe it's a great idea. Anyway, these guys emphasize that more than we do. And the idea is really you go from this, you begin, as you develop some concentration in meditation, there's this quiet joy. But actually, even that joy subsides and there's pure equanimity. But they all just come and go. And of course, the other thing that comes and goes is a lot of thinking and wishing you could get up and worrying, because that's the way meditation is. But these things happen. These things happen as part of the meditation process, and they're conducive to peace. The Buddha taught 7 factors of enlightenment, and I have developed them all. I have found what is vast and empty, the unborn. It is what I have longed for. I am a true daughter of the Buddha, always finding joy in peace. So here, rapture, equanimity, tranquility, concentration are completely integrated. Always finding joy in peace. You don't have to look for joy in some kind of external circumstance. You don't have to look for joy in getting something that you want. Because peace is actually the basic condition of the mind trained in meditation. And that's the locus of the deepest, most vast, expansive joy that you can find. Always finding joy in peace. This makes me think of a few lines of Hongji. The drifting clouds embrace the mountains. The family wind is relaxed and simple. The autumn waters display the moon in its pure brightness. It's pretty quiet. We point towards a quiet kind of joy. And what I haven't talked about here today that I usually talk about a lot is how this quiet joy can manifest in the form of us serving the people that we love, serving the people that we don't love, serving the people that we don't know, serving the world that we know about, giving ourselves completely to a world that we don't even know exists, people all over the world, offering ourselves, which is what we're going to do at the end of this thing in the 4 vows. We're going to say, those of us who choose to do it, I vow to save all beings. You don't know who all beings are. You just make the vow. You just crack your heart open for just a minute. So I haven't really talked about that today. But it's there. It's right there. And when you look at Buddha, what he did, he attained nirvana, right? That's what he said. And then what he did, he wandered around, and when people came to him for help, he talked to them. What did Padmasambhava do? She practiced, she wandered around, and when people came to her for help, she helped them. And what did Uttama do? Same thing. So, that's a natural expression of what I'm talking about today. So I thank Uttama for making these lovely verses and for her practice. So long ago, in the heat of the Jetta Grove in northern India, and here we are, it's not so hot. If it gets hot, we turn on the air conditioning. here we are. We get to do the same practice. Utama is not so far away. I encourage everyone to meet a teacher. Make a relationship, a sustained relationship with a teacher if you want to do this practice. And then do the practice. And then why not be well? Why not? It's an option that's available to us. How well can you be? How much wellness can you promote? There is not a limit. There is not a limit. You know, Padacharya was motivated to get well because she was in so much pain. Maybe you're not that motivated. But you go, hey, guess what? There's no limit to how much more well and how much more wellness I can promote. I'm just making that up, but I've never met anyone who reached the limit. So I'm just like, you know, maybe there is a limit. And when someone will come tell me about it, that'll be cool. For the rest of us, let's just keep going. Let's just keep going. So I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you. And I would be really interested to hear if you have questions. That's cool. You could ask questions. Or if you want to say something about perhaps the relationship in your life between having a teacher and your practice, that would be interesting. Or maybe you can say how you don't like having a teacher. That'd be fine too. Anyway, I'm just interested if anyone has any words they'd like to contribute.
It's kind of more academic, but like there seems to be this alternative tradition where these women are sort of doing this Buddha thing alongside of Buddha. Seems to be inspired by the Buddha story, but it seems a bit countercultural in some way. I don't know if they're maybe you expand on that. I haven't read the book. I'd like to.
Okay, so you're kind of asking about what the actual condition of the early Buddhist women within the Sangha and the Indian community,
yeah,
kind of a thing. Well, and you use the term countercultural. It is true. I mean, Mahapajapati, who basically was the impetus for founding the Order of Buddha's Nuns, who was Buddha's stepmother, who raised him because his mother died in birth, she wanted to be ordained within the Buddhist tradition, and he refused her. This is a kind of a long story. But she was very persistent. And a whole bunch of other women got persistent. And finally the Buddha was like, oh, okay. So it's a story which is complex. And, of course, the records we have, we don't know to what extent they're true. I think most historians would say what we is probable is there was a substantial number of Buddhist women nuns practicing the same practices that men were. They did practice in separate groups because they wanted to be careful about, they didn't want people having sex, basically. Let's see. Yeah, and it was countercultural because there were almost none or very, very few. There were a lot of similar groups to Buddhist groups in India, like the Jains and all these other people, teachers walking around like Buddha who had their body of thought and their body of practice, and they had followers. Buddha's was very successful, but distinctly he was one of the only ones that did allow women to be ordained. And in that regard, he kind of supported this impulse of empowerment that Mahapajapati had. And all these other, lots of women who were like, we want to do this. And he's like, okay. So.
Sort of on the same line, you know, recording the history of this and who records history and how the story then gets told as a result. I wonder about the story of
Padacharya.
Anyway, and I got caught in it, so I confess to that. Foraging around, dead hair. I think about Siddhartha, you know, going out, you know, that he had nothing hair, and you know, all these things. And I wonder if there is some bias in the recording of the story of a woman who has done the countercultural thing.
Mm.
So, you know, she's crazy, you know, because she's defined culture and she's going out and doing maybe a lot of the same things that...
Well, I'll provide a counter because there are contemporaneous accounts of other women who are actually just doing their own ascetic practice can't remember their names right now, but there are several. Bada Kapilani, for example, was, she was a Jain originally, and then she was actually a master debater, and she was traveling around doing her own like ascetic practice, and there are numerous accounts of women doing that. I think Padachara was in a different boat, although it's hard to say, but it's not that this literary tradition would not acknowledge women who were non-Buddhists who were doing practices like that, because they did. And yeah.
What was the original cause of their suffering?
Oh, the story is really wretched. She had basically everyone in her family died through a whole series of unbelievable tragedies. It was the first time I heard the story, I just wept for about 20 minutes.
Was she the one who let that go around and ask?
That's Kisako Tami.
I want to put in a plug for a woman teacher who is more accessible to us, and that is Deepa Ma. And if you've never heard of Deepa Ma, someone here in the Twin Cities area has actually written a biography of her, and she is a really interesting teacher who lived in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I encourage people.
Cool. Yeah. Deepa Ma.
I have been so grateful to the people who I have met here who are my teachers. I was surprised at first, incredibly humbled by how much time people are willing to give to listen, make time for you. Even if you walk into something like Dhammasana, you feel like you're babbling because you don't really know what you're supposed to say, or, you know, but the people are just really willing to meet you where you are, regardless of whether things are going well or whether you're really struggling. There was a point earlier this year where things were really tricky, and I was really struggling with new things that were coming up during meditation, and I was meeting with one of the teachers here, but while I was waiting, the newsletter was sitting on the counter, and it was Tim's article about growing and in your practice and how he used the analogy of the egg, and the chick is pregnant from the inside, and the mother is happy from the outside to let them know that somebody's out there. And I remember the thing that Joe mentioned in the article, something about the teacher saying, "I am pecking from the inside. Thank you for tapping up. Will you tap on the outside? You know, like, will you help me know that you're out there?" And I just thought it was so completely appropriate and a little funny, because that's kind of exactly what I felt like at the time. So I've been very grateful to have people who are willing to tap on the outside when I'm trying to figure my way out.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Ben. And thank everybody for your comments. I was coming back to what you said at the beginning about the process that's going on in the United States and elsewhere, where Buddhism is being transmitted into the 21st century culture, where all kinds of things are happening. And things have changed in many ways compared with traditional societies. And I think humanity is kind of shuffling along, trying to figure out the solution to this problem of how to live and how not to destroy the earth in the process. And we're looking for... we're developing our practice, I guess is what I'm saying. There were some old ways of doing things. We're adapting them. We no longer, you know, not reciting things in Japanese. and there are lots of changes going on. So, here's the thought, my brother. Buddhism, like most of the religious traditions that I know about, arose in, here's an emotionally laden word, a patriarchal society. And perhaps the practices that are part of this tradition of Buddhism don't speak to to everybody, and in particular, maybe they don't speak as well to women, who make up 50% of humanity, as they do to men. So I certainly think that looking for women teachers in the Buddhist tradition is an excellent idea. I think we need to cast our net more widely and mm-hmm. just look at women spiritual teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, not just women, but other people who have been excluded as well. And somehow or another find a way of incorporating that.
Yeah. Let them all in.
Piggybacking on your experience so much of the same as you did coming in, and also going to Doha's not the first time. I went in and said, you know, I don't really even know what to say, but Ted told me I should come in and talk to you, Tim. So, and being stupid was okay too. And the idea of women, we have 11 priests here, and 5 of them are women. And, you know, just hanging out with them has made a difference in my life. Much less, you know, going to the class and studying Buddhism, understanding this more fluid way of being. That this is different from the old Buddhism in Japan. We're
evolving. And
I just think that for me, it's
just
been so rich and
made
a huge difference.
Thanks, Pamela. I see the Doan tapping his watch. So thank you very much. It's really just wonderful to hear what people have to say and to you.